You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of July, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Raffaello Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute will set our day's agenda. Raffaello, what do you have for us today?
Well, this morning we've got day two of the big US-China strategic and economic dialogue. We've got the Luxembourg Prime Minister who's been brought down by a spy scandal. And the UN, the Russian ambassador to the UN has finally pointed to the Syrian rebels, saying they are also using chemical weapons.
Also coming up, French tycoon Bernard Tapie has his assets frozen by a court in Paris. Corruption, political favours, misusing public money. We'll be live in Paris looking at the allegations.
And we'll also hear how New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg's bold new management style helped transform City Hall during his 11 years in office.
If I worked in a previous administration, and if I wanted to meet with the mayor, I'd pick up my phone from my office, and I'd call my secretary, and my secretary would call the mayor's secretary and ask when Kevin might meet with the mayor. In Mike Bloomberg's administration, if I need time with the mayor, I just walk over to his desk.
Also coming up, the first of two special reports on the evolution of Brazilian culture and what it says about the country's identity.
As a fine artist, a contemporary artist, covering the true history, in a way, exposing the true history of what the complexity of Brazil is, and goes all the way to contemporary art, so comes through history of Brazil, in a way.
All that, plus we'll look at this morning's Italian front pages as well. That's all coming up here on Midori House on Monocle 24.
That is the next 58 minutes. The next few minutes will be Barney Burnham. He's got your news headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Senior American officials say the US is going ahead with plans to deliver four F-16 fighter jets to Egypt, despite the current political unrest there. The planes, part of a total order of 20, are expected to be delivered in the next few weeks. Eight were sent in January. The last eight should be shipped later this year. Meanwhile, the White House says it will take time to determine whether the removal of President Mohamed Morsi was a coup. There have been dozens of deaths in violence across the country since the army ousted Morsi last week and announced a political transition. White House spokesman Jay Carney.
There is a crisis in Egypt, and the way to move Egypt beyond crisis and towards a better future is for the authorities to embrace a process that is inclusive, that leads to a transition back to a civilian, democratically elected government.
North Korea says it won't give up its nuclear deterrent until the United States ends what it called its hostile policy towards Pyongyang. But officials said they were ready to revive international talks on its nuclear program that haven't taken place since 2008. So Se-pyeong, the North Korean ambassador to the United Nations, has been speaking in Geneva. He warned that a joint U.S.-South Korean military exercise planned for August would raise tensions on the Korean Peninsula and hoped the U.S. would cut official military ties with the South.
If the United States has a real intention to put an end to hostile relations with my country and set up and conclude the peace treaty, is to make a right decision to dissolve the UN command force and replace the armistice agreement with a peace pact.
Police in Quebec say 30 people still missing after last weekend's freight train disaster in the town of Lac-Mégantic are probably dead. 20 bodies have been found after the runaway train carrying crude oil rolled away from its overnight parking spot and crashed into the town. The resultant explosion destroyed at least 30 buildings and forced around 2,000 people to leave their homes. The rail company chairman told reporters in the town that he didn't think sabotage was involved and believes an engineer failed to apply the brakes when he parked the train overnight. The investigation into the fatal Boeing 777 crash at San Francisco Airport has heard that an Asiana pilot initially told flight attendants not to evacuate the plane. National Transportation Safety Board chairwoman Deborah Hirschman says passengers were told to stay in their seats. The evacuation only began 90 seconds after the plane came to a halt when a flight attendant saw fire outside the window. The first emergency crews arrived 30 seconds later. Pro- and anti-abortion activists have been holding a vigil outside the Irish Parliament while legislators debated whether to legalise abortion under certain conditions. A two-decade debate over a Supreme Court ruling that abortion be permitted when a woman's life is in danger was reopened last year when a woman died after being refused an abortion of her dying fetus. Now, Prime Minister Enda Kenny's government is proposing access to abortion if a woman's life is threatened. Caroline Simons is a legal consultant to the pro-life campaign.
The only procedures allowed in this bill are procedures which will result in the death of an unborn baby, and with no indication that this is going to have any role to play in saving a woman's life. And it is the case for all of your listeners, you should know, that for any complication of pregnancy that a woman might have, she is and has always been entitled in Ireland to every intervention and every treatment necessary to save her life.
Luxembourg's Prime Minister Jean-Claude Juncker will formally resign today following a Secret Service scandal. He's Europe's longest-serving leader, but he said he'd step down following claims that he failed to stop illegal security agency activities such as phone taps and corruption. Mr. Juncker has been Prime Minister since 1995, and fresh elections will now have to take place. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. Barney will be back at the bottom of the hour with another check of the world news. It's 6 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
London, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. It's time now for us to set the day's news agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Raffaello Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute here in London joins us in the studio. Raffaello, many thanks for coming in the studio. Where should we begin today?
Well, I'd say why don't we begin in Washington, where we have the US and China having their big annual strategic and economic dialogue. This is a big keynote event. We're at the fifth sort of round of these discussions. They were started initially under US Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson. And the idea was to have a sort of high-level economic dialogue between the US and China. The idea being these are the two sort of big economic actors on the world stage. And also it was a way the Americans thought, well, maybe we can engage with the Chinese on this. They have a lot of difficulty sometimes getting this sort of interface. So that was a huge success. And then as a result, they started to develop a sort of strategic parallel track as well. And this now been merged into this big keynote event that goes ahead every year, which, you know, for the Chinese is a huge deal. I mean, here it's been reported less and the US press has got a bit of coverage. But I mean, in China, this is the big story. This is the big meeting where their big senior guys can go meet with the American counterparts. And, you know, it's their way of discussing the world's issues.
And as China talks about it and sends their big players out there, what are they hoping they will come back with? What are the sort of the sort of headline issues from a Chinese point of view?
Well, from a Chinese point of view, it's very much sort of demonstrating this discussion goes on, you know, and I think we shouldn't underestimate the importance of the process from a Chinese perspective. In terms of the tangible outputs, of course, the Americans are much more fixed on that. And so, you know, going into this, the big push was against cyber, you know, and they had discussions yesterday. It was raised. Vice President Biden gave one of the big inaugural speeches. And he, you know, highlighted cyber theft and property theft and all these sorts of things. But they also had very substantive discussions on climate and other issues yesterday. And then, of course, you know, the Chinese foreign minister has demonstrated he's a bit of a comedian at the same time by coming along and saying that, you know, the US-China relationship should be like a married couple. And he said, not like two men. And it should not be like Wendy and Rupert Dung either. So, or Murdoch. So.
Bit of humor in there.
Yeah,
obviously,
exactly.
The intelligence and the cyber issue comes at a very delicate time for China and the U.S. Of course, Snowden is still MIA. You know, that showed the extent of the U.S. intelligence operation, eavesdropping operation around the world. Another big issue, of course, though, is the economy, economics, currency manipulation. The Americans don't use that term currency manipulation, but it has been floated out there.
Yes, it's repeatedly floated as something that certain congressmen will point to. The U.S., the Treasury Department is very hesitant to point to China as a currency manipulator. Because there is evidence that Chinese currency is moving in a direction to maybe to parity. It's still very tightly controlled. But there's some evidence that they're at least letting it move in a sort of direction that the US would want. It is constantly raised. I would say that it's maybe been made less of a priority or less of a shouting point this time, simply because I think there's a perception that, you know, there's a recognition that China is doing something about this or trying to do something about this. There are other sort of issues that are on the table as well. Climate change, as I said, was a big one that was spoken about yesterday. And then the sort of bigger strategic questions that underlie the relationship, sort of North Korea. Mm. You know, what is going to happen there? North Koreans, we've just heard, they're sort of continuing to sort of rattle their sabers a little bit. This is still an issue there that ultimately the US and China see themselves as the two discussants. And then, of course, Secretary Kerry, who would be, in theory, the sort of leader on the strategic side and the US side, is unfortunately not going to be there because of his wife's illness.
I mean, this idea of a level playing field seems to be being mooted around this around these talks in relation particularly to the cyber issues, to do with intellectual property. Mm. And it seems that there is a movement for the US to want to even things out so that they both see this whole sort of new Wild West kind of world in the same way. I mean, is that one of the big sort of thrusts this time round to try and smooth things?
The cyber thing, yes. I actually think the cyber thing this time is really more of a management, a sort of control issue. Because as you say, the Snowden question has really sort of, you know, thrown the cards up in the air from an American perspective. You know, it's maybe less surprising that the NSA is doing all this activity, but the fact that it's been so publicly uncovered after the US had been making such a song and dance about what the Chinese do, and that in fact it turned out that Snowden revealed that, you know, US authorities have been targeting, you know, some universities in Hong Kong, some universities in the mainland. This is the sort of civilian infrastructure that one wouldn't expect a security agency necessarily go after. And that, you know, frankly, the Americans constantly point to the Chinese. But I think the important thing is that from the, you know, the Chinese see this as a strategic security question in some ways. And sort of this is a security tool that we use. The Americans say, well, you know, you're not using this just in that way. You use this to steal our technological information for to advance companies and to advance sort of national economic benefit. And that's where they see the differences lying. But again, I think that this is very much something that, you know, as I say, Vice President Biden made it a big point in his speech, but I think it's one where the Americans are a bit more on the back foot this time.
And Raphael, let's come back here to Europe. 18 years Jean-Claude Juncker was prime minister, world record of prime minister of Luxembourg, but he is stepping down. Tell us why.
Well, this is a fascinating story. I mean, Juncker himself is a sort of a big beast of European politics, who frankly a lot of people probably haven't heard about. But he was, as you say, 18 years prime minister of parliament of Luxembourg, one of the smaller European member states. But more importantly, he's seen very much as the man who helped sort of keep the euro together as the head of the Eurogroup finance ministers in the EU. And he's, you know, repeatedly been mooted as the potential new president or prime minister, the head of the European Union. He has now been brought down by a Sky scandal, which is frankly wonderful in its sort of old-fashioned Jean Le Carré style.
Well, yeah, the spying, bugging, it's all out there. He's been sweating, apparently.
Yes, well, exactly. He sweated during his sort of big during the parliamentary appearance, and his response is, "I'm not perspiring because I'm scared, but because it's hot."
So, I mean, takes a measure of sort of, you know, great political humour to be able to sell a gag like that, doesn't it?
It does. It takes a certain amount of chutzpah. But, you know, the scandal is one involving pretty much everything you can imagine. It turns out the spy agency was going completely amok, doing whatever it wanted. It was bugging people, dealing in stolen cars. One of the more interesting elements was that apparently they kept tabs on about 13,000 secret files on various people, and they ran a whole fictional counterterrorism operation that was essentially a front to help a Russian oligarch pay $10 million to a Spanish spy.
It does sound like something out of a movie, doesn't it?
I'm sure we'll be seeing it in Hollywood soon. Yeah?
And Raphael, finally, a story involving Syria. Russia making claims that the rebels are making their very own sarin gas.
Yes, I mean, Syria is one that we've been talking about for a long time, and I think we will continue to talk about for a long time. This is now the Russians are coming back. We had the US, and we just had the UK Parliamentary Committee, Intelligence Security Committee, come out yesterday with a report that the British security services are getting very worried about the government's use of chemical weapons in Syria. Now, the Russian UN representative has said that the Syrian rebels were using sarin gas that they'd produced in cottage industries of their own in an attack on government forces.
Sorry to interrupt you there. It starts to feel and sound this sort of claim and counterclaim. It starts to feel a little bit kind of sort of cyclical, you know, the days of if X happens, if X is discovered to have happened, what, you know, Y will follow, clearly are behind us. And so we have claim, we have counterclaim. But I guess the question is, will any action follow from
this? I think the sad point, the sad truth is no. I think we're going to continue to see this sort of treading of water of everyone else's. But I mean, the other thing to emphasize is there's a big story in today's Guardian newspaper here in the UK, where they look specifically at a part of Syria, and they look specifically at what Jabhat al-Nusra, one of the leading Islamist groups, has been doing there. And they're really creating a mini state within a state now, within the parts of territory they control. And this is showing that this is not, you know, simply a situation of a civil war where, you know, there's some sort of end in sight. We've got groups that are now really taking territory, turning it into small states, starting to sort of tax, starting to, you know, create all the levers of state. And it means that the situation is hardening in such a way that I think we're moving beyond a point where, in fact, any of these sorts of government statements about, you know, if this happens, we will do this, are relevant anymore.
And as you say, there doesn't seem to be any end in sight anytime soon. Raffaella Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute here in London. Many thanks for joining us on the programme. Great to see you.
Coming up in a moment, the assets of one of France's most famous businessmen have been frozen. The fraud scandal that's dragged in several key figures from the country's business and political elites continues to grow. We're live in Paris in a moment.
For the latest Monocle news, previews on upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop of all of our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com.
Welcome back. Bernard Tapie is one of France's most colourful tycoons. He's a multimillionaire. The sportswear brand Adidas is one of his many former business interests, and he served as a government minister. He's also won 2 Tour de France titles and 1 Champions League trophy, or at least his sports teams have. He's dabbled as well at being a pop star. That chapter in his varied career sounded like this. C'est pas trop tôt. Arrête de compter en barrette.
A talented man indeed.
I would say that is.
Yeah, but Bernard Tapie currently finds himself in the headlines for far less silly reasons. Authorities are preparing to seize the tycoon's assets over allegations that there was fraud over a 400 million euro arbitration agreement from 2008. Well, that agreement was made because of a long-running legal battle with the state over the sale of his shares of Adidas in 1992. Tapie thought all was well and good, though, but when Sarkozy, the man he supported, was defeated in 2012, authorities opened an investigation into the arbitration agreement at 400 million euros.
Well, indeed, as you can hear, it's a complex case and one whose tentacles, it seems, stretch far and wide. Amongst those to have already been called as a witness, IMF Chief Christine Lagarde. Well, to discuss the latest developments, pleased to say now, we're joined by Christine Ockrent, commentator on French politics and former chief of 24, of France 24, I should say, the news network, of course. Christine, thanks for joining us. We tried to sketch it out there. It is a very complicated business, but it started with this sale of Adidas shares, which it was claimed later there was a fraudulent act committed in the midst of it. Is that fair?
Yes, indeed, and I think your summary is very accurate. It's indeed a very complex case, if only because, you know, the sums involved are staggering. But originally, what happened is that Crédit Lyonnais, one of the major French banks, which is owned partly by the French state, that's at least Tapie's claim, defrauded him by buying his stake in the in sports company Adidas for an amount of more than 300 million euros, but only to sell it a year later for more than double. So since that time, Tapie has been shouting, suing, saying he had been cheated, and he got the support, if not of Sarkozy himself, which is of course what the French investigation team wants to prove, but certainly of the man who was key to Sarkozy's staff at the Élysée, Claude Guéant. And so the next man probably to be called by the judges investigating the case is certainly going to be Guéant, who was Secretary General of the Élysée, that is to say, again, the number two guy in the former Sarkozy power structure.
Talk to me about how French reaction has been over this. It's a startling amount. These are involving some of the most influential and powerful political and business figures in the country. What's the coverage and reaction been like there where you are?
Well, of course, there's huge coverage. But what is interesting, there are very mixed feelings about Bernard Tapie, because Tapie is no aristocrat. Tapie started, you know, from the banlieue in a garage. He did indeed try as a pop singer in the beginning. And so he very much plays the part of the sort of popular guy from humble classes who's made it to become very rich. And so feelings are very ambivalent. On the one hand, people applaud at his extraordinary pugnacity and talent. You know, he went on TV last week on the evening news, and he stammered at the poor guy anchoring the news, and he had that famous quote. He said, "Oh yes, of course. You know, it really hurts, doesn't it, that a poor guy like me coming from the banlieue has become so rich, and that's really what hurts." And that, you know, it rings a bell in the sort of French popular conscience, who, you know, people who, after all, did send aristocrats to the guillotine. So Tapie has that sort of backing. On the other hand, for the elites, he is the caricature of the maverick who's been into business, into politics, wheeling and dealing, in a very obnoxious style. And so it's really a very passionate debate, not to mention the fact that there are very tricky legal questions into this mess.
Well, and he's been very keen to get his side of the sort of publicity machine working as well. You mentioned that that long interview he gave. During that, he said words to the effect of, he's been executed before he's been sentenced. Again, perhaps recalling a bit of French revolutionary language there. His assets have been seized, as we said. Is there a sense of unfairness towards the way he's been treated at this point?
I think there's certainly a sense that the judiciary are banging on his head before any judgment has been passed, and it has all to be considered with a very political background, having to do with former President Sarkozy, and indeed the fact that Sarkozy himself, either directly or indirectly, is being hit at in various scandals. And the Tapie affair has, of course, Sarkozy and Sarkozy's power system as a background.
Well, let's talk there then about Nicolas Sarkozy. Right now, you know, he is contemplating a potential political comeback to reunite the fractured UMP party next elections, 2017 presidential elections. How damaging is this potentially for that political comeback? Keeping in mind, though, he does have immunity to anything that potentially went down during his presidency.
Well, it is, I mean, the Tapie case keeps agitating all these question marks about what Sarkozy himself did or didn't do, and what his proxies might have done in his name. That being said, Sarkozy's return to the political scene earlier this week had more to do with the fact that our constitutional court declared that his spending for his electoral campaign had been excessive, and that his political party has to pay back some 11 million euros. And that's why Sarkozy had to come into the front seen again to reassure his party comrades that he's still their leader. But as you said, the next presidential election is in 2017, which is indeed, you know, a long time to go, and anything can happen in politics. So I don't think, at this stage at least, there's no direct relation between the Taipei case and Sarkozy wanted to make a comeback. He knows, you know, the political animal that he is, that it's much too early to make a real comeback.
Excellent stuff, Christine. Fascinating, fascinating story. Christine Ogren, political commentator and co-founder of France 24. Many thanks for joining us here on Midori House.
Now, in this week's episode of The Urbanist, we are focusing on city halls. We head to Toronto, to Sao Paulo and to Las Vegas to look at the shifting role of the city hall in our metropolises. But in this preview, we're heading to New York. The physical form a city hall assumes isn't always in the hands of its architect. When Michael Bloomberg moved to New York City's City Hall in 2002, one of his first acts was to rearrange the furniture and with it shift the work climate inside the building too. Instead of moving into the ornate office his predecessors had occupied, he ripped out the benches of the large Board of Estimate chamber on the second floor and installed simple, unassuming cubicles, including his very own, at the centre of the hall.
It is known as the bullpen. The room has been heralded as the ultimate symbol of his management style, a Wall Street-inspired layout that conveys transparency and accountability. Well, Monocle's Pauline Eiferman visited City Hall and met with Mayor Bloomberg's former deputy mayor, Kevin Sheekey, who worked in the bullpen.
I remember walking through the building very late one night in probably December of 2001, right after the mayor got elected, and he was going to take a look at the new office space that he was going to move into. It is a typical government building. It is very small offices, and the delineation of power in all executive suites, particularly in government, is the closer your office is to the president or the mayor or the governor, the more important you are. So everyone wants to have their own office. It's important to have an office, a door, and a secretary out front, right? And then the closer that setup is to the chief executive, the more important you were seen to be. Mike Bloomberg's style is obviously very different. And when he walked around 10 or 11 o'clock that night with a custodian for the building who was showing me around, he kept looking at what walls could he tear down on the first floor. And a very nervous custodian, you know, thought about the walls that are going to come down and where all these offices are going to go, until the mayor made his, or who would be the new mayor, made his way upstairs to a large chamber. But it was a hearing room, you know, almost looked like a big church hall. Had lots of long wooden pews. It had a stage. The mayor traditionally would give some speeches up in this room where the city council would hold hearings. Well, Mike Bloomberg walked into the room and his first thought is, great, we'll work here. And the church pews came out and desks went in. The mayor put his desk right in the center. And for 12 years, he's worked at the center of a very large room, trading room style, people would say, surrounded by seven deputy mayors and senior staff. All of the people who report directly to him are in the same room as him. Over time, it evolved to become even more functional. A large TV screen was added that had all of the local news broadcast. You could take any of the traffic cameras from anywhere in the city and put it on that screen. You could take the police helicopter and put it on that screen. Counters were added to how many 311 calls were coming in on a daily basis. So the city gets, I think, about 36 to 50,000 calls a day to its helpline. One of the mayors had done was to create a single phone number for people to call. And if you get into the office at, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning and you see that 10, 20,000 people have called already, maybe more, you know something's going on. So you can ask about what's going on. The other advantage, I think, and this is the real advantage to what Mike Bloomberg's brought, which is sort of transparency and communication, which is if I worked in a previous administration, let's say I was a deputy mayor, as I was downtown, but if I was a deputy mayor for a previous mayor, I'd have my office and I'd have my secretary out front. And if I wanted to meet with the mayor, I'd pick up my phone from my office and I'd call my secretary, and my secretary would call the mayor's secretary and ask when Kevin might meet with the mayor. In Mike Bloomberg's administration, if I need time with the mayor, I just walk over to his desk. And that can happen 20, 30, 50 times a day. If Mike Bloomberg needs me, he doesn't have to someone call me and I don't have to be found. He looks over and he can see if I'm at my desk. And if I am, he doesn't have to walk over. He can yell and I'll walk over. And he can talk to anyone he wants 20, 30 times a day. You know, I think the other thing that works with inside of Bloomberg, which some people cringe at, but is really part of the magic, Because people say, well, I'm working this big thing. What if I have a doctor's appointment? You can go to a doctor's appointment. Or what if I have personal business? Well, first of all, you're paid to work. You're not paid to do personal business. If you need to, you can grab your cell phone or go somewhere else. The point being, though, that the fact that I can sit next to someone and actually hear what they're doing and see who they're meeting is actually a very important part of an organization working well. If I can hear what the person next to me is talking to, I can say, oh, you know, I talked to that guy last week. Let me tell you what we're working on with him. Or if I can see the mayor comes in and meets with a city council person, a business leader, I could say, you know, I saw that you're meeting with so-and-so. You know, here's one of the things we're working on with him. And so the transparency in seeing what your colleagues are doing and the transparency in seeing who your colleagues are meeting with and vice versa is actually a very important part of making a culture more productive. And so I actually think that working in this, you know, so-called bullpen pen style, as Mike Bloomberg is fond of building, whether it be at his company, at a campaign, at a business, is a hugely important part of how productive he's been. It's a hugely important part of why his company is as productive 30 years later as it is. A hugely important part of why New York City has gotten so much done.
And I know that this style was actually copied by a lot of different organizations. Do you think it can work for anyone?
I think it works for anyone. I think, unfortunately, again, that because the decision has to be made from the top, a lot of chief executives want their own creature comforts, and so they don't do it. It's been copied by surprisingly few politicians. Mayor of Washington, D.C. did it, maybe a few others. You know, the pull of that private office for people who reach the top is very difficult to overcome.
And do you know what happened to the original mayor's office?
So Mitch Rare's office sits downstairs. It had been redesigned, but largely speaking, it gathers dust.
Kevin Sheekey there was talking to Monocle's Pauline Eiferman from New York City's City Hall. And you can hear our City Hall special edition of The Urbanist in full later today at 1900 hours London time here on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
Now, in the next half hour of the program, we'll be bringing you part one of our special report on cultural identity in Brazil by Monocle's Jack Phillips.
Discussion now that Brazil is like these three pieces of pie together, which is the indigenous people who are here and the Brazilian region, as well the Africans and what became the Afro-Brazilians and the Europeans who came.
But before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. Senior American officials say the U.S. is going ahead with plans to deliver four F-16 fighter jets to Egypt, despite the current political unrest there. The planes, part of a total order of 20, are expected to be delivered in the next few weeks. Eight were sent in January. The last eight should be shipped later this year. North Korea says it won't give up its nuclear deterrent until the United States ends what it called its hostile policy towards Pyongyang. But officials said the country was ready to revive international talks on its nuclear program that haven't taken place since 2008. Police in Quebec say 30 people still missing after last weekend's freight train disaster in the town of Lac-Mégantic are probably dead. 20 bodies have been found after the runaway train carrying crude oil rolled away from its overnight parking spot and crashed into the town, causing a huge explosion. The investigation into the fatal Boeing 777 crash at San Francisco Airport has heard that the pilot initially told flight attendants not to evacuate the plane. The National Transportation Safety Board says passengers were told to stay in their seats and the evacuation only began 90 seconds after the plane came to a halt when a flight attendant saw fire outside the window. Pro and anti-abortion activists have been holding a vigil outside the Irish Parliament while legislators debated whether to legalise abortion under certain conditions. The government's proposing access to abortion if a woman's life is at risk. Luxembourg's Prime Minister Jean-Claude Juncker will formally resign today following a Secret Service scandal. Europe's longest-serving leader said he'd step down following claims that he'd failed to stop illegal security agency activities such as phone taps and corruption. There's the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. The time is 16:34 in Tokyo, it's 11:34 in Dubai, and it is 8:34 here in London.
Now, what does it mean to be Brazilian? 200 years of immigrants would probably give you different answers, and in the last two decades, the economic growth spurt has made Brazilian identity even more complicated. Now, for the first of two special reports, Monocle's Jack Phillips has been to Sao Paulo to try and find his own answer, looking at the country's art.
Brazil was a country that is easy to fall in love with. Its cities are noisy and congested. Its countryside is lush and vast. But where there are people in Brazil, there is always art, music, and an abundance of culture. With the preparations for the World Cup in 2014 and the Olympics in 2016 in full swing, its cities are booming. These events bring a spotlight down on a country's people, giving them a platform to showcase their individuality and diversity. And it's this diversity which best describes it. It's a country made up with migrants from Africa, Japan, Portugal, and continental Europe. And so the music, art, and food take its influences from all over the world.
Eu sou viciado em pizza, mas não tô sozinho nessa.
Duda Penteado is a born and bred Paulistino. As an artist, he lives between Sao Paulo and New York, where he paints, teaches, and lectures. He is a strong advocate for the city and for brand Brazil as a whole. He is passionate about his craft and about what Brazilian art has to offer the rest of the world.
This is what makes us different than animals, and animals are very complex. They have the diet, they communicate with each other, they have organizations, they have hierarchy, you know, they have a ways of his own languages that we don't understand. But this is what we do then different than every other animal. We have a need to register ourselves. We have a need to create those things that we call art, or to me it's just a language of the soul. We have the need. At the same time, there's so much hunger and this and that. We need this. We need to feed the soul. We need to feed the body. That's the complex issue of mankind, to me, can never walk from.
Sao Paulo is home to some of the most intriguing homegrown art on the contemporary market. The city's small galleries offer a beautiful selection of local and internationally recognized Brazilian artists. But what are the questions being asked by Brazilians and its art?
As a fine artist, a contemporary artist, covering the true history in a way, exposing the true history of what the complexity of Brazil is, and goes all the way to contemporary art, so comes through history of Brazil in a way. But it's important to me as an artist, like, because I live many years in the US, in New York, and then Sao Paulo is going back and forth. Because as living outside of the country, thinking a lot about who I am as a Brazilian, who are the Brazilian people, it's important to understand that discussion now that Brazil is like these three pieces of pie together, which is the indigenous people who are here and the Brazilian region as well, the Africans and what became the Afro-Brazilians and the Europeans who came. We cannot disassociate that Brazilians are not either to the indigenous or Africans or Europeans. We are the Brazilian people that mix, that Hartin was saying. And denying that truth is denying who we are.
Privy to the inner circles of the cultural scene, he collaborates with many of the institutions, galleries, and research facilities that are pushing Brazilian art onto the international stage. I met with Duda at the Brazilian Museum of Sculpture, an underground concrete bunker of a collection. Designed by the Pritzker Prize-winning architect Paulo Mendes de Rocha, it's a place where sculpture is made, displayed and discussed. Director Olivio Guedes told me of the museum's conception.
The museum is in an important location. The building is important. If it didn't have a soul, it wouldn't be important. The soul of the museum is transdisciplinary. It is a space for beginners to learn and grow, and we hope to change the state of their minds.
Set on a 75,000 square foot triangular site, The large concrete structure contains underground internal spaces and has an exterior with water pools and an esplanade. It's housed in one of the most affluent parts of the city. The museum and surrounding grounds sit within a plush residential street. As crime figures are high in the city, most homes are gated, with security details often patrolling the perimeter fences. So how does the museum draw in its public when the city appears so guarded?
Paulo Mendes is an architect with political and communist teams within his work. The museum in this neighborhood worked towards a wider contemporary concept of architecture in Brazil. We are in an elite neighborhood. We bring children from the favelas into the museum and teach them about the art. This tackles the idea surrounding the elitism in art. The art, instead, becomes a social issue.
Torna-se aqui no Brasil a arte como uma questão socializante.
With a series of talks on offer, as well as vast private collections of work to look at, the museum seeks to create a space that encourages learning and social inclusion, something that Olivio deems important.
As palestras,
the lectures represent what we think the soul of Brazil is. We invite doctors, physicians, and engineers. The architect vision is not enough. No vision is enough. This space can never be enough.
A stone's throw from the sculpture park is the Museum of Image and Sound. Dating back to 1970, this large modernist building houses permanent exhibits and an exhaustive archive. It has the backing of the Secretary of Culture Department, and it's a non-profit organization. MIS, as it's more commonly known, is an image and sound meeting place for people where cultural discussion aims to expand the creative community. Executive Director André Sturm has been leading the trajectory of the museum for the past 2 years and is passionate about the role it plays within the city.
We have an important archive, which we are really working hard to have as much as possible digitalized. So it's a photography archive is already 30% digitalized. The music and video, it's quite 90%. So we are working hard on that. In the other side, which is what people see, because this is a kind of secret work, people don't know about that. We try to have here a very strong program of exhibitions, of music, of cinema, and all kind of arts connected with image and sound.
With a series of programs and events that span workshops for children to dance and film editing schemes, MIS and its concerns are multidisciplinary. Known for their young artist residency programs, MIS has become renowned for its focus on nurturing talent in Sao Paulo, utilizing the space and its funding to ensure that artists have a space to learn and mature.
We challenge choreographers to come here. They can choose any area of the museum to present the work, but the work must have connection with projections, live music, so it's dance with image and sound. So the idea is really to go to the limit of the image and sound and not only be with photography and cinema, but everything that we can do here. In the exhibition area, we have from classic exhibitions, like we did last year about Georges Méliès, to very, very avant-garde things. Like this month, we are going to open an exhibition. It's called Labi Miss from Laboratory. This is a program we have here. We select 4 young artists every year. They do a residence here for 3 months, so they can develop one project with curators, teachers, people. When I say they have some teachers, it's not in terms that the teacher is going to do a class, but it's more a kind of mentor. It's a way to put some light, to give some instruments, some tools to these artists to develop.
The museum is ultimately a forum for cultural expression with a focus on practical skills. Visitors not only have access to an increasing archive of sound and images, but selected individuals can gain access to the institution's vast array of image and sound equipment. Every year, space is given over to 6 aspiring bands to rehearse and produce music. Six photographers are given wall space to exhibit their work, and 5 filmmakers are taught the intricacies of light and special effects in a purpose-built studio. In 2011, there were 25 galleries at Miami Basel, representing Latin America. In 2012, this increased to 26. At Frieze 2012 in London, a record amount of galleries exhibited from Latin America, set to rise again this year. There is an upward trend in the demand and interest in Brazilian art on the international stage, and the forthcoming World Cup in 2014 will go further in selling Brazil as an international cultural brand.
I don't think it's only Brazilian art, it's Brazil as a country. There is a big interest in Brazilian art, and Brazilian artists are getting this opportunity, which is very good. Part of what the government is doing for the World Cup, especially, it's going to stay. So it's going to be a thing that will be good for the population of Brazil and for tourists after, like changes in airports, in roads. So I think it's very, very good. And most of all, Brazil is a well-known country, but if you ask anyone out of Brazil, if it's not a specialist about Brazil, they know Rio de Janeiro, São Paulo, maybe Brasília. So it's going to be very important to cities like Natal, Manaus, Fortaleza, to be much more known, and people will discover new places to travel for tourism, for doing business. I think the World Cup is very good for Brazil. What I'm saying is that for the city of São Paulo, I don't think it's such a big difference, because the city of São Paulo is already very well known. Where I go, you know, people know about São Paulo, know it's a big city. The international airport of São Paulo, it already changed, you know, and it's much easier now to go through the customs, to go through immigration, which, you know, usually it took like 40 minutes, 1 hour, now in 15 minutes you go. So all of that is benefit for the country.
The presentation now by Rio, which will become the first South American city to host the Games. Now, since they're located in the Southern Hemisphere, those summer games will be played, as they were in Sydney, not really during the summer.
But what of the Olympics in 2016? How will this affect Brazil?
Olympics, it's one city, so it's different. Of course, going to be great to Rio, but I think that World Cup is much, much bigger. You know, it's World Cup is the biggest event in the world. 10 times bigger than Olympics in terms of repercussion, you know. If you go to Botswana, people know about the World Cup. If you go to Nepal, people know about the World Cup. So, you know, there is more countries associated to FIFA than to ONU. There are more countries fighting to be in the World Cup of Brazil than associated to ONU. There is 182 countries playing soccer, fighting to be in the World Cup, so associated to FIFA. And there is only 178 countries associated to ONU. So there are countries which are not in ONU, not in FIFA, but there are more countries playing football and trying to be in the World Cup than in ONU. So it's really something that is completely around the world.
That report was by our own Jack Phillips. He was reporting from Brazil, and you can hear the second part of his series on national and cultural identity in Brazil here on tomorrow's edition of Midori House.
You're listening to Monocle 24. We'll be checking in with our correspondent in the Hungarian capital next. That's right after this. And you are listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 8:49.
And it is time to check in with our correspondent in Budapest. His name is Adam Labor. Of course, Adam, how are you today?
Good morning. I'm fine, thank you.
Excellent. Nice to have you with us. And first up, Hungary has got 500,000 new Hungarians, apparently.
Yes, 500,000 new Hungarian citizens. The government passed a law a while ago, making it very easy for the Hungarians outside the borders, as they call them, to take up Hungarian citizenship. This is a legacy of what happened in 1920 at the Treaty of Trianon. Hungary was reduced by two-thirds. So there's 10 million Hungarians living in present-day Hungary, but there's another 5 million or so scattered around the borders in Serbia and Slovakia and Romania mainly, also some in Croatia and Ukraine. So the government's done a big in-gathering. But this is very...
Adam, it's a very... what do you think he was going to say? Very complicated issue?
I think it's a complicated issue. Yeah, it's quite exciting.
We'll find out what Adam was going to say in a moment. Stay with us.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delorne.
From Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dana.
For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
For Monocle. In Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levitchnik.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
I really hope Adam Labor's okay.
He's probably out celebrating with those 500,000 new Hungarians on the streets.
Let's certainly hope so. We'll have to find out later on what Adam was going to be telling us, but we'll have some music now.
Yeah, in a moment we'll also be hearing from our own David Pleasant. We'll be reviewing this morning's Italian front pages. Before we do, here is Mattia Bazar, and this is Ti Sento.
Mattia Bazar there with Ti Sento.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. It's time now for us to have a flick through this morning's Italian front pages. Joining us now in the studio is Monocle's own David Pleasant. Hello, David. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, Phil.
Good. Well, where should we begin this morning?
Well, we'll start with what's on all the front pages and a lot of the international ones too. Parliament was suspended yesterday in Italy as a result of the Berlusconi trial, the sex crime, the sex trial that's happening. He is, as a result of the protest of his own party, the PDL, the PD have joined forces with the PDL as an act of a kind of trying to diminish the impact of potential protests from PDL. The PDL had requested a three-day protest of Parliament. The centre-left PD met them in the middle and went on strike for one day.
Okay, so 24 hours, Parliament is going to be out of action. I mean, what state is the Berlusconi trial at this point?
Well, it's really reaching some kind of crescendo. Interestingly, Berlusconi is kind of stepping back and saying he wants Parliament to go on, but he would like his own party to support him. It's interesting just how this is playing out, that even the people not in his own party are feeling that they have to kind of act in solidarity against him. Of course, all the other parties were in complete furor. There were all sorts of quite comic scenes of protest from the other parties not involved, i.e. the Five Star Movement and also the Greens and various other parties wolf whistling, throwing things. I mean, it was quite a scene yesterday.
And this just underscores the fragility, doesn't it, of Enrico Letta and his coalition.
Exactly, which leads me to the other story that's making the news in the Corriere della Sera, but many others. Standard & Poor's have decided to downgrade Italy's rating from, if anybody knows the difference, from a BBB plus to BBB.
That
so they've
is,
taken
that
away
is
that
pretty,
plus.
It's pretty bad. Mm. I do know the difference and it's pretty bad. No, I mean, in all
you sense, tell me, Dom.
It's just above the junk rating, essentially.
Yeah, it's only very slightly above and it's already in very dark territory to be BBB+.
U.S., isn't it?
Exactly. So that's and they cite mainly the reasons of public accounts lacking proper rigor. They were expecting more already from the new government, and also the government's pledge to scrap various taxes, including the EMU property tax, was cited by Standard & Poor for their downgrade.
Okay, so Parliament suspended. Very big concerns over the ratings. I mean, you really need to let off a bit of steam. Maybe, I don't know, how do you relax? Maybe smoke a cigarette, but you can't even do that anymore.
Well, you can if you're...
The
e-cigarette, exactly. And as many listeners will know, there's been various debate at the European level, certainly, over whether to ban the sale of electronic cigarettes. It's still in debate whether the harmfulness of those, but in the Italian Parliament at least, you can still smoke them in the lower house, and many politicians seem to be doing that on a daily basis during sessions. But the Senate, somewhat progressively perhaps, has banned it. So just as well, if you're an MP in Italy, you can still light up or steam up. But if you're a senator,
steaming up.
Well, they've got a verb for it in Italian. It's svapare, which means it's kind of like a take on a drag, but with vapor, so you can still svapare.
What I wonder is, so they've put this ban in one of the houses recently. Until the e-cigarettes turned up, were people allowed to smoke regular cigarettes?
No, so they weren't. No,
they'd already stopped smoking in the house. And
exactly.
Now they're like, well, why don't we smoke some e-cigarettes?
They're just taking advantage of new trend, new technology. It was
to vapare the day away.
Exactly. Senators are being respectful in the House, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think the senators, are showing some decorum, Phil.
I think. I agree.
And after the shenanigans yesterday in the lower house, it's all the more admirable what they're doing in
those
the Senate.
Those MPs could take a few lessons, I think.
Well, I wonder why the division? Why is it that they say, those guys in the lower house, they kind of need
it? I don't know. There's often these kind of battles between the lower house and upper house, as in a lot of democracies. I think that the Senate's trying to, show the way forward, really.
David Pleasant, excellent stuff. Many thanks for coming in.
David is, what's his title? You're a Monocle researcher, I suppose.
Exactly, I'm a researcher.
Really wanted to give you a title there. That's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. Our producer was Thomas Lewis. Our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tess McCann, and Jack Phillips was the studio manager. Culture with Rob Bound is up next.
And I'll be back with Tom Edwards for tomorrow's edition of Midori House. That's at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Dominic Reynolds. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.